It's been an extraordinary week for the leaders of FIFA, world football's governing body, with scandal, accusation and counter-accusation. David Goldblatt now traces FIFA's long march towards sporting and cultural power and its present troubles. FIFA. Football, politics and power.
Have you any questions to ask?
What is FIFA is a very good question.
The FIFA World Cup is the greatest show on earth.
Crisis? What is a crisis?
Power is concentrated in Zurich on the hill in the big building and one man. This time is over.
Allegations of bribery, crisis, the backstabbing and the internal feuding threaten to tear his organisation apart.
What is a crisis?
The price of globalisation has been increased corruption.
The 2022 FIFA World Cup is Qatar.
That is astonishing.
The FIFA World Cup has become the greatest show on earth, a celebration of the universal virtues of play. Its gigantic television audiences are the closest that we come to humanity as an imagined community. Like all international sports federations, FIFA, the global governing body of world football, holds the game in trust for the rest of us and claims to serve our universal interests. Its latest motto is, for the game, for the world. And just for a moment, awarding the World Cup to Qatar appeared inspired. The Arab world's first sporting mega-event, and combined with Russia's successful bid for the 2018 World Cup, a recognition of the new global geography of power. Just 6 months later, the legitimacy and standing of Qatar's World Cup bid and FIFA are in tatters. This moment has been a long time in the making. In the last half century, FIFA and the world of football have been transformed by the globalisation of television and economic and political power. A transformation FIFA was institutionally ill-equipped to deal with. To understand the origins of FIFA's current malaise, we start in Paris in 1904, where representatives of seven European football associations founded the organisation. The British, although implored to join, stood aloof and distant, suspicious of foreign involvement, and as Paul Dicci, France's leading football historian, explains, of their wider social mission.
There are a lot of organizations which aimed to create internationalism in many fields, art, sciences, culture. The creation of IOC 10 years before the creation of FIFA was part of this movement. So the first intention was to insert football in this movement of internationalism, organize, develop international football.
Ambitious internationalists, maybe, but for the next 40 years, FIFA was a tiny organisation. It was run on goodwill and voluntary service and was often at odds with the home of football, the British. Absent at the moment of creation, the British did join FIFA only to leave the organisation twice after the First World War and remained outside the FIFA fold until after the Second. Unperturbed, FIFA continued to grow, adding new members on every continent. And in the late 1920s, it began to plan for its own global competition.
The creation of the World Cup in 1930 is a result of a huge conflict between FIFA and IOC. Born with the success of the football tournament, one of the most popular events of the Olympic Games, and a major source of income. But in the same time, the footballers were not real amateurs. After the Olympic Games of Paris 1924, the IOC decided to apply a very restrictive definition of amateurism. FIFA officials were convicted that they need to organize their own competition, a competition open to the professional, and a world competition.
And at that point, the first global super team had emerged at the Olympics, Uruguay.
Professor Alan Tomlinson, co-author of FIFA and the Contest for World Football.
That team was a new model of organised national play, a particular nation who could see the real value of football for profiling themselves on the global stage.
The first World Cup in Uruguay was already a state affair. Gain for Uruguay thanks to the activity of Uruguayan diplomat. He made a tour of all of Europe, first of all to convince the federation to give the World Cup, and then to convince some European associations, only four, to participate.
Other nations could see the potential of entering this unique, new, unprecedented global event.
The British press barely reported the 1930 World Cup, but the rest of the world took note. In 1934, Mussolini's Italy staged the Second World Cup and applied the arts of political stage management and global PR to the occasion. After the war, the live television coverage of the 1954 World Cup in Switzerland turned a global level of interest in the tournament into a global audience. In 1958 in Sweden, Brazil's magnificent victory and Pelé's debut created football's first truly global spectacular. As the dismantling of European colonial empires gathered pace, FIFA's membership steadily grew larger and more global. Yet despite all of this, FIFA continued to be a tiny voluntary organisation. Now based in Zurich, its headquarters was a twee suburban villa. It gave its TV rights away for nothing. Under Swiss law, it was treated no differently to a village bowl society and taxed accordingly. Half a century later, nothing has changed. Into this world walked Sir Stanley Rouse, previously secretary to the FA, and in 1961, FIFA's sixth president.
Well, Sir Stanley, your 75th birthday, warmest congratulations from us all.
Thank you very much indeed.
You're going to be the longest-serving Englishman in your post as president of FIFA. Coming up, I believe, for your third election, which is another 4 years, which means, again, looking back, something like, what, 35, 36 years closely associated with the game?
Since 34, yes, when I became secretary of the FA.
Astute, canny and quietly driven, he took office as FIFA president in 1961 at the age of 65. He had inherited a world that was changing out of all recognition.
I'm surprised every time I go to another country. 2,000 miles up the Amazon, one finds a brand new stadium being built and 40,000 people attending a match. And we've got 140 countries in membership now in FIFA. And there are others applying. I think there are 9 others applying to become members.
And nearly all of those new members would come from the independent nations of the Global South. As Paul Darby, author of Africa, Football and FIFA, argues, the new players meant the rules of the game were going to change as well.
European football nations had treated FIFA as a private club in terms of access to high-profile administrative places, hosting rights for the World Cup in terms of opportunities to participate in the World Cup. And then with the collapse of empires, you have the emergence of what were perceived to be upstarts agitating for access to some of the benefits that came with membership. So the club effectively was being democratized with the collapse.
The first thing they do when they get their liberation is to apply to FIFA to become members and then to UNO to become a member of the political organisation.
First things first, in other words.
Yeah, so they get their priorities right.
African nations, when they acquired their independence, of course, what they wanted to do was to assert themselves on the world stage. So within the space of maybe 5 to 10 years, there was a considerable African constituency within the context of FIFA. And of course, this generated huge problems for the world organisation.
Left to himself, Rouse would have just pursued a modest programme of technocratic modernisation, rationalising the bidding for World Cups and spreading best practice in administration and refereeing. However, as Puldici argues, the new nations, especially African nations, had other ideas.
Rouse considered African football was a young football, which had to prove its value. So before to reserve 2, 3 or 4 places to the national team from Africa, FIFA should wait for at least 10, 20 years. And the conflict exploded at the occasion of the English World Cup in 1966. Only one place at the final competition was reserved to Africa, Asia and Oceania. Following the example of Ghana and Tunisia, the major part of the African Federation decided to boycott the preliminary competition to the World Cup. Thanks to that, they obtained for the next World Cup one place reserved to Africa. But they wanted more.
They didn't just want more places, they wanted political change, particularly on the issue of apartheid South Africa.
They changed the culture of FIFA because for the white and European and South American officials of FIFA, football and sport was officially neutral. The struggle against apartheid was a kind of way of finding unity against one enemy. The main problem for them, the presence, I'm not an Anglophobe, of Stanley Rouse.
He fought quite hard to ensure the South African Football Association remained a part of the FIFA setup, while at the same time the African nations were calling for South Africa's exclusion from FIFA. for the African nations, progress was far too slow. And of course, waiting in the wings was João Havelange, who was a completely different character from Rous.
João Havelange was a supreme networker who had woven together a tapestry of sporting, political and industrial contacts that had made him a millionaire businessman, a member of the IOC and since 1970, the president of the Brazilian Football Association. His challenge to Rous arose from a mixture of vaulting ambition and simmering discontent in world football with the dominance of Europe. He was multilingual, charismatic and ruthless, as shown in this 1996 profile, recording his response to the challenge of unseating Rous.
My first reaction was to say no. I had only one thought. I flew to England and had dinner with Sir Stanley Rous, and I told him that of the two of us, there would be only one winner. He put his arms around me as a grandfather would a grandson, and I think he didn't believe it.
Equipped with an air ticket that weighed more than a kilo, supported by Brazilian embassies and government monies, Havelange sought to mobilise the new majority in world football, appealing to African nations by promising to expel apartheid South Africa and to all of the developing world with promises of money for facilities and training and more places at the World Cup.
Then came the FIFA Congress of 1974 in Frankfurt, and there at the age of 79, you were defeated.
Yes, I won the prize because I knew what activity was being practiced by my successor.
I remember just before the second ballot was taken, you sat down and had an orange squash quietly in one corner.
Yeah.
João Havelange did so much lobbying, he was really just a blur, and that was where you lost, wasn't it?
Yes.
Gentlemen delegates, the new president of FIFA is Mr. Havelange.
Rous departed with his dignity intact, but privately he was shattered and refused both a FIFA pension and the suggestion that the new World Cup trophy should be named after him. In his place, a very different president and a very different FIFA were about to emerge. Close aide and former media director at FIFA, Guido Tognoni.
Havelange was the biggest personality FIFA ever had, physically strong, and his physical presence was really impressive. You know, he was tall, he was like a man made out of steel. When he looked at your eyes, you did not know what was coming. You know, he was friendly, he was correct, he was a gentleman, but he was also a dictator. You know, he knew exactly how to make use of his power.
The problem that he had when he came to power was that FIFA was not the multi-billion dollar industry that it is today. The World Cup was barely breaking even. So what Havelange did was to seek relationships that would allow him to generate the finances through which he could fulfil his election promises. And probably the first relationship that he established was the most significant with Horst Dassler, of course, the head of Adidas. And Dassler was keen to develop a relationship with Havelange for his own commercial reasons. Obviously, he wanted access to the higher echelons of the game, which would enable him to win lucrative contracts. Horst Dassler promised Havelange that he would find the finances. The difficulty that Horst Dassler had was he didn't have the money either.
Horst Dassler's relationship with both Havelange and FIFA was extremely close because FIFA was a vehicle for Horst Dassler to grow. He was a pioneer in sports marketing, as we all know, but he was also a pioneer in, let's say, in the less wonderful sides of sports. You know, he introduced a system of bribing people. In those days, the people, they were not aware that they were doing something wrong.
Dassler had almost everything. FIFA's ear, global connections, marketing brilliance. But he needed someone who could persuade the world's biggest companies to back football. That man was the marketing expert, Patrick Nally.
Horst asked me if I would join him to see if I can help make the plan of Havelange work. And one of the companies that I was working with was the Coca-Cola company. And I spent a long time looking at how football being the universal sport, Coca-Cola being the universal drink, could actually, with the universal language, work closely together.
In the 1970s, Coca-Cola didn't have the kind of global coverage that it has today. I mean, you couldn't buy it in India. It was incredibly hard to get it in the communist nations of the world, as they were in those days. Was there a sense at Coca-Cola that football, if not quite a Trojan horse, was certainly a way of getting to the parts they otherwise couldn't reach?
The whole basis of our initial discussion was very much on that brief. FIFA gave them the ability to go around the world.
So Coca-Cola effectively provided the finances that allowed Avalanche to fulfil his promises to the African continent. But what, of course, that process also did was to trigger a recognition in Avalanche's mind that if he wanted to continue to be the figurehead of FIFA, he would have to go down this route of commercialisation.
Nally had brought Coca-Cola to the World Cup. Now he had to make sure the World Cup worked for Coke. But FIFA's capacity to manage events and commercial deals was still sorely lacking.
FIFA had been, like other federations at that stage, run very much on the amateur lines that did not understand the commercial realities of where their sport was going. In the 76, there'd been a military coup in Argentina. I started asking FIFA, how are we going to give Coca-Cola a very strong presence and a very exclusive presence in Argentina in 78? And of course, FIFA couldn't answer that question because FIFA didn't have the rights. It didn't control the stadia, it didn't control the stadium advertising, there were no rules, regulations, no legal agreements. So effectively, I had to go back to the Coca-Cola company, cap in hand, and ask them if they would actually advance to us some 12 to 15 million Swiss francs so that we could actually buy back the rights that we needed so that FIFA could offer its new partner Coca-Cola an exclusive relationship with its own World Cup event.
Was there any uncertainty amongst Coca-Cola, FIFA or other potential sponsors that there might be a damage to their brand supporting an event going on in that kind of regime?
Yes, and I was sent to Argentina on both Coca-Cola's behalf and FIFA's behalf to come back with my view. It was very frightening then. I think the first time I went to the man I was meeting had been blown up in his bed the morning of our meetings. We travelled around in what were like gunships. When I used to ask about why everything was quiet now, was everybody hiding? And somebody said to me, no, 6 foot. And it was only many years later did I realise what 6 foot meant. But what I did find was a great desire to really do everything they could to make sure that it did work well, to actually present itself in a good light.
1978 was a dress rehearsal, paid for by the Argentinian junta. 1982 was the first Avalanche World Cup, and he had promised his many backers within and without an altogether larger adventure. Only nobody had told the Spanish hosts.
When Spain bid for the World Cup, it was 16 teams. For FIFA to actually live up to Avalanche's requirements to add more teams from Africa and Asia, we had to take the World Cup from 16 teams to 24 teams, to 14 stadia. There was a requirement either to say, no, we're not going to host it because this is not what we bid for, which meant that they would have to find another nation to adapt it, or come to an agreement to subsidise the Spanish. And Mr. Dazzler in the gentleman's toilet came and told me that, Patrick, no, the amount of money that you think you've offered needs to be increased by another 40 million.
What did you think at that moment?
Terrified. It was a big hike. And the only way to create a rationale to why that hike was of value was that we had to make it very exclusive. So only one company in its product category could actually benefit not only from advertising signage, but also from certain broadcast rights, all the licensing, the merchandising and licensing and emblems and marks, everything about a World Cup or these other events only available on an exclusive basis.
And with that, the package of exclusivity and global coverage that defines modern sports sponsorship was born. And with it came money. So much money. Guido Tognoni.
FIFA came from nowhere financially. I know that in 82 they really had nearly empty cash boxes. In 86 it was a contract which was a value of 49 million Swiss francs for the world television rights. Peanuts today, but it was a big money in those days. So it was a restless expansion of the power and of the influence of FIFA. We were creating new tournaments, you know, under 17, under 20, under 23, the Women's World Cup, and so on and so forth. It was like a river which was flowing constantly, and it's huge, huge, huge money. And the problem is you have not to work hard for that money. You know, it flows in, it falls from the sky like a wonderful rain. And this is always dangerous. All over the world, it is dangerous if you get the money without working hard for it, because then you do not appreciate anymore what you do and what you get.
They certainly didn't appreciate Patrick Nally, who found himself excluded from the charmed circle when Horst Dassler formed ISL, a sports and rights marketing company that would control FIFA's media rights from the mid-1980s until 2001.
I was too successful. The program was extraordinarily successful. Mr. Dazzler needed funds and finance for his own developments of his many clothing interests in addition to Adidas, and I was cut out. So Dazler created ISL, born out of nothing, and suddenly had all these very successful programs and very successful activities. Because in essence, they were stolen. They were stolen from me. I had to live with that, unfortunately. Not long after ISL was created, Horst Dazler died.
Dazler was dead, but ISL was a company built in his image. Jens Sayer Andersen from Play the Game, the world's only transnational sports watchdog, describes ISL's operations.
ISL was by far the biggest sports marketing agency in the world and had contracts with all the biggest sports federations and the International Olympic Committee also for some time, dealing with broadcasting rights and sponsor and marketing rights on behalf of the international sports federations like FIFA. In the Swiss courts, it has been documented that over 12 years, around 140 million Swiss francs were distributed in secret personal commissions, flown around in attaché suitcases, channeled through secret funds in Liechtenstein and other tax havens, finally ending up on bank accounts belonging to, in particular, officials from FIFA.
In 1998, Havelange bowed out at the top of his game. In his 24 years of autocratic rule, FIFA had become a much slicker and wealthier operation, and in the world of global politics, a real player. It had ceased to be a club of amateurs and had become a political machine whose offices were worth fighting over.
The growing phase was so quick and so dramatic, and with the full cash boxes, I think they lost a little bit the track. FIFA started to be a multilingual, multi-international body. All of a sudden, with the lots of money falling in, it was more and more important to see who was in the executive committee, who was president, who was in the special committees. FIFA detected its own political power, its own political way of life. It really became more and more important all over the world. And FIFA, all of a sudden, was a brand.
The global boom in football's importance and wealth that began under Havelange reached new heights under his successor, Sepp Blatter.
Mr. Blatter very soon understood how FIFA worked and the mechanics of sports marketing and the chance what football has in the world and the chance he had himself. He was the closest person to Joao Havelange. He knew all the secrets and all what he was doing. The man who really saw the chance, maybe better than anybody else, what football could mean for the world.
However, just as the boom gathered pace under Blatter, so FIFA's problems escalated. ISL, which had appeared an invulnerable business with an extraordinary portfolio of sporting rights, went bankrupt, a victim of overambition and slack management. When the Swiss authorities started looking through the company's files, another story began to emerge. Jens Sayer Andersen.
And this was when the massive corruption system was discovered. Later there was an court case in Switzerland against six ISL directors for embezzlement of ISL money. These six ISL directors could freely talk about how bribes, secret personal commissions, this was like paying wages. And if we did not pay those money, we could not work. And why could they tell that so openly, those noble business directors? Because until 2006, that kind of business practices was perfectly legal in Switzerland. Now, it is no longer legal for FIFA leaders or any other with a relation to FIFA to take money in return for selling the TV and sponsoring rights because, among other things, it is destroying fair competition. But with regard to internal procedures in sports organizations, like the allocation of mega events, like election procedures and so on, Swiss jurisdiction does not interfere if there are irregularities. This is still very much protected by the association status of FIFA, although FIFA has not been a typical bowling club for many, many, many years.
As an international organisation, FIFA is legally and politically out of the reach of most national courts and governments. But now, even their Swiss hosts have become impatient with FIFA's behaviour. Swiss MP Roland Buchel.
People are just fed up to have this reputation problem with a body like FIFA. Sepp Blatter himself calls them now angels and devils. It explains much more than what we can explain. A few weeks ago he said there was no corruption at all, or at least no systematical corruption. Now he completely changes his mind. He says that he will solve the problems by June. I give him much more time. He shall solve the problems by the end of the year, but then they should be solved. We know what happened. with the ISL nearly £100 million of bribery. Clean up your act by the end of the year, and then we'll see if more has to be done. One language they understand is the money. So if they have to pay taxes, full taxes, it will be much more than £100 million.
Just as the IOC was blown open by the corruption around the Salt Lake City bid for the 2002 Winter Games, so FIFA is being blown open by the bidding for the 2018 and 2022 World Cups. Over the last 6 months, an ever-accumulating charge sheet against FIFA has emerged. 10 members of FIFA's executive committee have had allegations of corruption and unethical practice made against them. The Sunday Times has reported that the Qatari World Cup bid bought votes. Most extraordinary of all, Mohammed bin Hamman, Qatari FIFA vice president, mounted a campaign to unseat the incumbent Sepp Blatter. A revengeous tragedy appears to have been unleashed. Bin Hamman and Jack Warner, another member of FIFA's executive committee, and both former allies of Blatter, have now been accused of soliciting votes for monies. Both men have denied the allegations, but have been suspended from office by FIFA's ethics committee.
Crisis? What is a crisis?
The crisis may not be clear to the president, but in football associations, parliaments, social media networks and news programmes around the world, the crisis of legitimacy is tangible. It is clear now that FIFA lacks the capacity to fulfil its duties, to hold football in trust as common property for the world and to serve the global public interest rather than its own. It was born of an era of uncommercialised and unpoliticised international sport. The arrival of so much money and power at FIFA, utterly unanticipated by its founders, has broken it. The idea that the president, under whose watch this disaster has occurred, is the man to reform FIFA, looks increasingly hollow.
FIFA, Football, Politics and Power, was presented by David Goldblatt and produced by Mark Berman.